specific about brain. So I think we focus a lot on the body, and we know what we need to do. We need to do running and weights and sleep. But for the brain, that's something that you highlight in the book as being very important. So how to monitor brain health?
Yeah. So this is the one I've probably been working the most on, certainly for the last few years, and very passionate about it. And so there's many things you can do. So I'll start from the standpoint of, this is a great example of what I mean by scientific wellness. So we have spent, by a recent estimate, about $1 trillion over several years and decades on clinical trials for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. And we have very little to show for that. You had the recent approval of lecanemab, for example, or Leqembi for the commercial name of it, which was the first, somewhat successful drug. It slightly slows down progression, and it does often come with, pretty horrible side effects as well. But it was, that was approved. Aduhelm was approved right before that, actually against, the scientific consensus of the, three of the scientists on there resigned in protest, because it clears amyloid but it doesn't improve cognition. And in fact, so that's kind of the disease-centric version. But the argument that I'll make is that we should spend much, much more of our time and effort on prevention. In fact, I wrote an article for the LA Times about this about a month ago, if people want to check that out. But basically, once your neurons have died and you've lost tons of synapses, the notion that you can take a small molecule drug to recover them, it's totally fanciful, right? There's no chance of that happening. You might be able to slow progression some and things, and that's kind of what we see a bit of. But prevention, which is keeping your neurons alive, is very doable, right? Much, much easier, very realistic, not sci-fi. Like, those things are not in the same universe of difficulty. And we've all known this since we're about 3 years old, right? It's the story of Humpty Dumpty, right? Once the egg has fallen and broken, no one knows how to put it together. Keeping it there, pretty easy. And so Alzheimer's is tougher than that, but there's many, many things you can do that will make a difference on keeping your brain alive. And in fact, we have spent the last few years at Thorne building out a detailed model of how the brain maintains health. So this is a computational model done with partners of ours that we have been able to develop, such that you can simulate the feedback loops of how the brain has to, what are the kind of things the brain has to do to stay alive. And so one of the things that you need to understand about the brain for your viewers, if they're not aware, is that your brain is a huge energy hog. It consumes 20% of your body's energy, and it is 2% of your biomass. So it's about 10 times more metabolically active. So you have to feed energy up to this thing all day, every day. And so as you do that, basically what happens is, as you get older, the oxygenation into your brain gets worse, right? Your arteries are getting a little bit narrower. Your microvascularization isn't quite as good, and so forth. So there starts to be pockets in the brain where you're not able to maintain positive energy balance. You're not able to make enough energy for those neurons to stay alive, and they die. And in fact, there was a beautiful study out of UCLA, an 8-year clinical trial where they did PET scans. And they actually have pictures of this now, where you can see these areas of what they call hypometabolism. And those are the first areas that die in Alzheimer's. We were floored when we saw this paper come out, because it was right in line with what we'd been doing with the modeling approach. And so the model takes into account over 1,000 papers now from the literature. So it's built, a lot of it's built bottom up mechanistically. And then we compare it against over 30 clinical trials and human research studies to look at outcome data. And we're able to match all of this really well with this mechanism. So as your neurons start, as you get into that lower oxygen condition, so the other big factor that people should know about Alzheimer's is there's a gene called APOE. ApoE4 gives you high risk for Alzheimer's, ApoE2, low risk. And so in the context of the model, one of the things that came out as being important was that if you want to keep energy production in neurons high, you have these supporting cells. You have about 9 astrocytes for every neuron. They support energy production in neurons. So your astrocytes will make lactate, your neurons will uptake that lactate, and they will turn it into ATP and make energy and so forth. And so when you do that, basically what it showed was that under low oxygen conditions, as you get older, you, in order to keep energy production in neurons high, you want to keep the concentration of cholesterol in astrocytes low. And so ApoE has a role in the transport of cholesterol. ApoE4 does it slowly, so you end up with high concentration. ApoE2 does it fast, so you have low concentration. And so if all you do is take those two facts, the lowering of oxygenation in the brain and the difference in the efficiency of making energy, of keeping your positive energy balance under those conditions of the transport rates associated with ApoE4 and ApoE2, again, which are measured, that recapitulates to you the age at which all those different genotypes get Alzheimer's disease. And, you know, this is where if I were giving a talk, I would show the data. But this is, to me, like pretty incredible, because it is, it shows that this paradigm around, you know, that amyloid plaques cause Alzheimer's has been wrong. And I think it's wrong because of this very disease-centric point of view. And I think if you take a scientific wellness point of view, which is what I'd argue we did, where we start from, not from disease, but how does the brain stay alive? What makes it healthy? What does it need to do? We only layered in the Alzheimer's data after that. And then we're pretty astonished at how well it predicted. And by the way, I could go for another hour on that. You know, I'm trying to, you know, I don't want to get us bogged down too much in all the details there, but it gets you to a paradigm where we can now have, with these digital twin models, we can take a set of blood measures and cognitive data from a person, and we can map probabilistically the likely age of dementia diagnostics or diagnosis, if they, given no change in lifestyle. But more important, we can predict all kinds of interventions that push that date out into the future. And it's not infinitely malleable. Some people it's much harder to move. Some people it's easier. Starting earlier is better than starting late, but we can do this all very quantitatively now in a way that I think is really remarkable. And I'm actually going to present on this to the advisors council for the NIH director in a week. Actually, I'm doing that in a week from now. I presented on this, to a group. I'm on a board at the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. You know, I got some feedback on it there because I wanted to get some talk. I gave it to a group at MIT and Johns Hopkins, various experts. You know, so we're, you know, this is something we're getting feedback on from the community as well. And so as you put these things together, then there's all kinds of areas that make a difference. And let me just go through some practical things that make a difference under this paradigm. So first, exercise is obviously very protective. And under this model, it makes a lot of sense. As long as you're focused on amyloid, it's not obvious why exercise would improve, you know, protein aggregates in the brain. If you're thinking about it more as an energetic problem, though, and you're trying to maintain oxygenation into the brain, it's obvious why exercise would make a difference, because you're just being able to pump more oxygen. You're able to keep more positive energy balance for your neurons. That makes a big difference. When we simulate these in the brain, one thing that comes out that's quite interesting is that a nutrient becomes rate limiting as your brain is dying, as your brain cells are dying. And then the most common nutrient that became rate limiting in our simulations was phosphatidylcholine. And so as a sanity check, we then go into the nutrition literature and we say, okay, do people that eat diets rich in phosphatidylcholine get Alzheimer's later? And the answer was, yeah, they do, about 3 years later on average, if they have a diet rich in phosphatidylcholine. You can get that in eggs. You can supplement with it pretty cheaply, but you can get it from, but you can also, eggs are a great source for it. So phosphatidylcholine, you know, and choline is, has been known for a while as being, you know, positive for the brain. So that's, you know, that's a big one. You want to keep your inflammation levels lower. So that, you know, so that's, you know, that, that matters. Let's see, other things, you know, that can make a difference. You want to be able to, well, one that makes a big difference, actually, I'm going to dive in on this one in a little bit of detail, because this is also going to show what I think is often done wrong in the way that we approach these things. And that's vitamin D. So vitamin D has a huge observed hazard ratio. So people who are deficient in vitamin D get Alzheimer's at 77% higher rates than people that don't. So that's a massive effect size. But there, and there was a big study, meta-analysis done for The Lancet, right? One of the top medical journals. And it gives a lot of these recommendations that I'm talking about here. Doesn't overlap 100% because of what we've done in the models, a little different, but it's, you know, close-ish, and it's got, you know, a number of factors that, that it has as modifiable. One that it does not include as part of the official recommendations is vitamin D. Now, the question, of course, would be why? That has an incredibly huge observed effect size. So the reason why is because there have been 4 randomized clinical trials done on vitamin D, right? Which is the gold standard, right? We're trying to assess correlation versus causality, right? That's a huge, maybe the question in science, you know, basically. And so these 4 trials were done. They didn't come out very well. So the conclusion was vitamin D correlation, not causation. Now, one of the things that's confusing there, though, is we actually know a mechanism for vitamin D. And so vitamin D, it binds to a particular enzyme or a particular regulatory protein. And this reverse cholesterol transport pathway, which I was talking about a little bit before, that we find to be really important. If you have good vitamin D, the regulation on that pathway tightens. So typically it's, so without vitamin D, it's quite choppy. And with vitamin D, the regulator is more efficient and it controls it better over the course of your life. So when we put that into the digital twin model and we simulate what's the effect of that process on when we would predict people get dementia, we find that if we put that mechanism in, they get dementia about 75% less, which is really close to the observation. Okay, so we have a conundrum here. It looks to us like it's true, but the RCTs, right, the gold standards say no. But this is where I'm going to push back a little bit. And this is actually what I'm getting into with the, you know, the talks that I mentioned, you know, the one I'm going to do for the advisory council for the NIH director here in a week or so. But basically, when we go through, we can, because the other thing you can do with digital twins is that you can simulate the exact trial. So we can put people, right, because we can simulate cognition, we can put the people in at the age they were recruited, with the interventions they were given, with the expected outcome, if our mechanism is true, right? If what we're saying, which is this complex model, right, that's a complex hypothesis of how the disease operates. And when we do that, what we find is that these studies, most of them are quite short. And they were, you know, so we put in exactly the age of the people, the length of time they're studied and so forth. And what our model predicts is that at the numbers that they have, we would expect there to be no difference observed in any of those RCTs. So in my mind, I have switched from thinking, oh, vitamin D is just correlation, not causation, to I'm going to recommend vitamin D to everybody for dementia until I see data otherwise, because the 4 clinical trials that have run look exactly like they would if what we're saying is true. And what I have come to believe is that the way that we go about clinical trials and prevention in many, many cases is very wrong. So let's just take the vitamin D example again. So one of the problems is you're isolating a single variable. Now, when we run the simulations, and the simulations are just so useful because you just get this bird's eye view of what, you know, if your view of the disease is correct, what should you see? And if you don't have it, it's very hard to do that. And so what we find there is for most people, a single intervention never does anything. Because if you take vitamin D, right, and you're tightening up that regulation, if you don't have any phosphatidylcholine, for example, you know, if you don't have a substrate going into that pathway, that doesn't matter. It's like optimizing traffic lights when there's no traffic. It's worthless, right? It makes no difference at all. And so a combination of factors have to be true before the vitamin D is helpful. Now, what we find in the simulations when we give recommendations to people, single interventions usually don't make much difference, but combinations make a lot. Like we can take four things that in isolation make no difference, and you do all of them, and all of a sudden you get 10 extra years. Like it's big. And so when you get into this, then, so my notion is that when we try to do these trials where we isolate one compound, what we're doing is we're setting it up such that you have to have a huge N, because you're basically hoping for random chance so that you get enough people where that's the final piece of the puzzle, right? It's like you have four broken gears in a clock, right? If you take out the broken gear, put in a good one, it's not going to work. You know, if you put in the bad one and then you take another one out, you put its good one in, you'll find that none of them matter. But if you fix the four together, you know, the gears start spinning and the clock starts working. It's very much the same in the body. And so what I'm arguing for is that rather than run clinical trials, especially in the prevention space, around one compound where almost everybody is a non-responder. Well, the other problem in vitamin D is if you wanted to get the size of trial to get, you know, where that random last thing would matter, the problem is it doesn't work economically. Because if you prove that vitamin D is helpful, that's not $1 billion a year drug. It's vitamin D, you can buy it for $5 from anybody. So it's like, you know, it's cheap. You know, you could buy it from Thorne, you know, $5 or $6, you know, but it's like, you can get that from a lot of places. So you can't justify the economics. Now, if you flip that then to saying, we're not going to test a compound, we're going to test a model of the disease. We're going to test the digital twin model. And what that does is that every single person that comes into the trial, we'll give them, you know, 3, 4, 5, what, you know, some set of interventions that we expect will make a big difference for them based on their physiology. But what's given to you is going to be different than what's given to me. It's going to be different than what's given to the next person, right? It's going to be, everything is going to be unique. But what are we testing? We're not testing a compound. We're testing this complex understanding of the disease as represented in the model. Because then what we're saying is that we take, and then you can just do an RCT just like you would, because they're good for many reasons. So we'll randomize a group that's then into, that's getting the advantage of what's happening in the model, and a group that's not. And then we test those groups against each other. And so that is a very different paradigm, but I think it makes radically more sense, because we will be able to do trials where most people are expected to be responders rather than almost nobody being a responder. It makes your N much smaller, makes it economically viable, even for things that are not going to turn out to be radically. And this is the justification that the drug companies give, right, for the, you know, the super high prices on, you know, so vitamin D, right, which can have, you know, this big effect, costs virtually nothing. But if you want to take one of the drugs, they're tens of thousands of dollars a year. You can probably take, you know, like vitamin D and phosphatidylcholine and, you know, some of these things for your entire adult life cumulatively for $7,000 or $8,000 or something like that, probably across your entire adult life. So it's, you know, you're just talking about, and exercise is free, right? Exercise doesn't cost you. And so many, many things like that. And so this is where I get into just the notion that so much of what we have set up, I think from both the medicine and the sometimes even the science perspective, we're not getting the answers that we actually want to get. And I'm actually joining get into that, but we're getting involved in, you know, a number of, you know, of efforts, you know, including at the government level and so forth, that are engaged on, you know, alternate methods of how do we think about, you know, different strategies for, you know, understanding this complexity, different strategies of clinical trials, different different ways. And a lot of that is so essential because I think that's how we're going to make prevention really make a difference. In part is the digital twins, because you can see at least simulations of what the effect is that you're having. You can test that in populations. The hard thing in prevention is you never can prove that you prevented Alzheimer's in a person, right? Mm-hmm. You can say, oh, I did these things, I didn't get all, right? You never know, because you can't run the counterfactual, but you can know if you've changed it for a population. And that's what we have to show.
Mm.
Anyway, that was a lot, but there's a couple of things I'm thinking about these days.
Right. And I'd love to dive into digital twins, but no, yeah, we definitely don't have time.
We'll move on.
Yeah. But so one other thing on the brain. So I saw you talked about Brain HQ, right? Which is like exercise for the brain.
And, yes.
I know that, you know, I've seen a game called Duel and Back. I don't know, do you know Duel and Back? You know, it.
No.
So that was subject. It's a memory game, but it was subject to a couple of papers and review. You know, they studied it, but the results were ambiguous as to whether it actually helped you do anything better than play the game. So are you seeing, are you seeing improvements in general function from playing the kind of games in, was it Brain HQ?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there is quite a lot of controversy in that area for the reasons that you gave, right? Which is that, you know, for many of these, games, and I do think that there's a lot of advertising around, you know, brain training and brain games that I don't really believe in for sure. Now, the reason that we highlight Brain HQ and why I am, a proponent of them is really down to one, the founder there, which is Mike Mrzenich. So Mike is a emeritus professor from UCSF and is one of the world's leading experts on brain plasticity. In fact, so much so that he won something called the Kavli Prize, which is basically it's the neuroscience equivalent of the Nobel, right? There's no Nobel for neuroscience, but the Kavli Prize is basically their Nobel, only it's three times more money. So that's a nice thing. So the Kavli Prize is a very big deal. So Mike is one of the leading neuroscientists alive, basically. And so he started this company, Posit, that does Brain HQ. And they've published about 250 clinical trials now, you know, in different research studies. So they've done, so I put them in a different category than I do most other. And I'm not saying there aren't any other good ones, but to me, they're just gold standard. And the thing that I think is a bit unique about what Mike has done compared to most of the brain training out there is, for one, I should call him Dr. Mrzenich, he's such an eminent scientist. But anyway, one of the things that that he has done is to really evaluate the brain as the brain is a physical object, right? Which is maybe obvious. We've just been talking about that. And so you can exercise it the way you exercise your heart or your muscles or your whatever. And it's really based around this notion of progressive overload, just like we do in muscles. And so what Mike does that I think is different from at least a lot of the things that I see advertised online, and why I think it is, that the games are set up to push some aspect of your cognition to its absolute limit and then try to push it a little bit further. So, and this is the kind of thing that in your day-to-day life, or if you're solving a crossword puzzle or a Sudoku or, you know, any of the various games that we do to, you know, occupy our mind a little bit, that's the difference that I don't think is there. So when you're doing the Brain HQ, it's going to, you know, it'll flash images at the very limit to where you can distinguish them, right? And then over time, it's going to try to get you so that you can recognize it in a fraction of a millisecond faster than you used to, and so forth. And some of that is definitely you're getting better at the game. But I think some of that is translating into, okay, you now have a quicker way to do it. It does the same with peripheral vision, right? So what's the absolute extent of your peripheral vision. And then it tries to show you things that are just barely outside it, right? Until you push yourself. So, okay, I can see something that's a little bit further than what I could see the month before or so forth. Cognitive speed, memory, you know, like, so he goes through all those things. So I just think it's really well thought out. And it is doing something that I just don't think you do in your day-to-day life, which is push something to its absolute limit. And so that's what they've done all these trials on, which is really to show that when you do these things, that there is some translation. Now, I do wonder to some extent, you know, how often are you going to be taxed at that limit, right? It's not going to, if your outcome measure is, you know, I don't know, you're driving or you're doing something, most everything that happens is going to be within your typical cognitive load. So it's one of those things that I also think just takes a while to manifest, much like the vitamin D, which is that if you're testing it in the short term, that tiny bit of extra that you get is probably not that impactful, right? Because what's the odds that something coming is going to be right at that edge? But doing it over the course of time so that so that over the course of a decade or two, you have an atrophied, that makes a monumental difference. And that's the kind of thing that gets into how hard it is to show sometimes these things in these clinical trials, because it is the kind of thing where I think, you know, they do have many trials that show effects, you know, under these, but the biggest effects are probably those that you don't readily see until, you know, over the course of time. The one you're in your 80s and you're still as sharp as you are in your 30s or 40s, like, you know, that's a big difference. And that's kind of at least the promise in the approach. So that's how I see that. And that's why I am a believer in Brain HQ, more so than just, but I'm not like blanket saying, oh yeah, all brain training games are good, because I don't actually believe that.